Next speaker is Roger Dingeldine. He's going to talk about Tor and censorship. Please give him a warm round of applause.
Okay, hi everybody. Please consider turning your cell phones off for the talk, as we've learned from the front row. So hi, I'm Roger from the Tor Project. Can you hear me pretty well? Am I too loud? Loud enough? Thumbs up? Great. Okay, so feel free to ask me questions for the rest of the next 3 or 4 days or something. We've got something like 5 or 10 funded Tor people wandering around here, so we're a growing project and we're all happy to tell you more about Tor. So today's talk is a little bit about what's happened in the past year or so in China and Iran and a bunch of other countries around the world. There seem to be a growing set of countries where censorship is becoming a real problem. It started out, everybody's thinking China and Iran and places like that, but the set of countries, Vietnam, Tunisia, England, Australia, Germany, Venezuela, the list keeps growing and growing of places that are considering censoring their citizens for one reason or another. So there are a lot of things we can talk about. I'm going to try to give you a bunch of different things to think about, and then maybe you can make use of that over the next year or so. So I'll give you a very brief overview of what Tor is. 3 or 4 years ago, I did a talk. It was, I think it was 23C3. It might have been 21C3 on what are we going to do about this censorship thing as it starts to happen. So at that point, I gave a talk about here's our planned design. Yeah, it's vaporware. And this year, it's, okay, so that stuff we were talking about, we built it, and here's how it actually worked. So I'll give you the brief overview of what Tor is, and then I'll give you a brief overview of what the problem is, what censorship is, what's going on around the world, what sort of problems we need to solve, what sort of designs we need. And then we'll get into the more interesting questions of what's actually happening around the world, what actually happened in Iran, things like that. So Tor is, it's an online system for anonymity. The goal is there are 1,500 relay volunteers around the world. Quite a few of them sitting in this room, I hope. And the goal is you can use the Tor network to browse the web or instant message, and somebody watching you locally can't figure out what sites you're going to, and somebody at the destination end can't figure out where you're coming from. So it's open source, freely available. One of the really neat things about Tor is the level of documentation and specs that we provide. We try to describe exactly in an RFC-style way how you can build your own Tor client. And that means that several different groups around Germany did it. I saw Alexei here earlier. He built his own Tor client a little while ago. And there are quite a few people around the world who are doing that because we describe exactly how you do it and what we think you get and what security properties we aim for. And that means that pretty much every university around the world that has people working on security have people working on Tor, trying to figure out how much security it provides, whether this new attack or defense works. So there's a huge community around the world of not just researchers, but developers and volunteers and people teaching other people, trainers and so on. One of the neat things about Tor, we started out getting our funding from the U.S. Department of Defense. And from there, we were funded by the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Since then, we've been funded by some other U.S. government groups. There's one called the International Broadcasting Bureau. They're the folks who run Voice of America, Radio Free Cuba, stuff like that. So part of the point here is the diversity of people who care about Tor as reflected in the diversity of where our funding comes from. And we're up to, I think, 14 people are being funded by Tor right now to do various things. Not all of them full-time, but that's quite a large group compared to 5 years ago when it was just me. So what else is Tor? We are also a real live 501c3, which is a US nonprofit. We work on not just developing anonymity tools, but also understanding what anonymity is and teaching the rest of the world why they might care. We've got some number of users. It's an anonymity system, so I'm not really sure how many. But probably more than 100,000 people are using Tor right now, and probably less than 1 million people are using Tor right now. So it's gotten to be a pretty serious set of people all around the world. Okay, so let's think a little bit about background. What are we trying to build? What sort of threat model do we have in mind? What's the big picture here in terms of what Tor does? So we've got Alice over here. She's trying to browse the web or something like that. We've got Bob over here. He's a website or some other destination. And the question is, What sorts of groups are able to watch this traffic, to figure out what's going on? Who can actually learn that it's Alice talking to Bob? So one possibility is there's somebody watching Alice's local network. Maybe this is the government of Morocco running their own monopoly telephone company. Maybe it's Comcast in the US watching its users. Maybe it's Deutsche Telekom. Maybe it's someplace in Frankfurt that gets to watch a lot of traffic going back and forth. Or maybe the attacker's on the Bob end. Maybe it's the FBI watching indie media or watching WikiLeaks, and they want to build a list of all the different people in their country or around the world who are reading the website. Or maybe the attacker's the website itself. Maybe it's Bob. Maybe it's CNN, and they're really curious who all their users are, and they want to be able to advertise to them better, so they need to learn where they're coming from. Or maybe it's somewhere in between. Maybe it's a backbone provider, Deutsche Telekom again, AT&T. Maybe it's an intelligence agency that's asked AT&T to be able to monitor the internet for them. I don't know if you've been following the NSA, AT&T wiretap story. So there are a lot of different places where the attacker could be. And if the attacker's in all of these different places, then we're screwed. Tor can't protect against that. We'll get to that in a bit. So what else are we talking about? Anonymity is not crypto. I talk to a lot of corporations who say, well, yeah, but I use a VPN, so I don't need this Tor stuff. I don't need privacy. I've already got my security. And encryption is good. You should use encryption. But even if you're using encryption, somebody watching this traffic going back and forth between Alice and Bob still gets to see who's talking, how much they're talking, when they're talking. And that's what most attackers, intelligence agencies, corporations, whoever's looking, that's what most people use these days. Nobody tries to break the encryption. It's all about who is the social hub, who's the person that we should investigate more, and then we can go wiretap them or break into their house or whatever we need to do to attack them next. And then there are some other variations on anonymity that we'd like to provide something stronger than. There are a lot of plausible deniability designs out there, like Freenet and some other peer-to-peer systems, where they say, yeah, I was involved in the transaction. Somebody asked me for the file. I gave them the file. But you can't prove it was me. Maybe I was relaying it for somebody else. And that you can't prove it was me, maybe it works in certain jurisdictions. But in some countries, like all the countries I was listing at the beginning of the talk, if you're in China at this point and the bad guys can narrow it down to six people, but they can't prove which one of those six people it is, that's not good enough. We need something stronger. And then there are a bunch of commercial anonymity systems out there, what we call single hop proxies. And the idea is all of the people put their traffic through that single hop, and the single hop, that company promises not to screw them. We promise we won't look at any of your traffic. Okay, we look at all of your traffic. We promise we won't write anything down. Okay, we log all of it. We promise we won't tell anybody anything we see. And we want something that's not based on, I could screw you, but I promise not to. We want something that's based on technology where there is no single location that has the information about which Alice talked to which Bob. So it's not a matter of, here's my policy that says I won't. It's a matter of, here's the technology that makes it so I can't. So part of the fun of working on Tor is the diversity of people who care about it. It's only when I'm talking to researchers that I tell them about anonymity. When I'm talking to my parents and my grandparents, I tell them I work on privacy. Because anonymity, that's kind of weird, but privacy, good point. Everybody needs privacy. And when I'm talking to Google and Walmart and other companies, I work on communication security or network security. Because privacy, we're a company. We don't need privacy. But security, yeah, you're right. We need that. And when I'm talking to the US Navy or other government or military groups, I work on traffic analysis resistant communication networks. It's all exactly the same stuff. It's the same software, it's the same network, it's the same security properties. The question is, how do you phrase it for them in a way that makes them realize that they want it? Because they've got lots of security. They spend all day buying crappy security from snake oil vendors, so they feel like they've got enough security. But when it comes to traffic analysis resistance, good point. I do need to send my agent to Israel, and I don't want anybody to know what his affiliation is or who he's talking to at the time or something like that. And then there's a fourth category we've been working on lately, which is human rights activists. For them, they like the privacy properties, but really it's about reachability. It's about, I can't get to CNN right now, and with something like Tor now I can. Or I can't read my local blogs because all of my local blogs are censored. Or I can't get to my blog, so I can't post on it because my government is trying to prevent me from doing that sort of thing. So part of the goal of Tor is to take all these different groups and put them into the same network so that they can blend together. You can't have the cancer survivors anonymity system, because if the only people who are using it are people who had cancer and are talking about it, then everybody knows why you're using the anonymity system. So the goal here is to have a lot of different groups out there. So if you see somebody using Tor, you can't conclude, aha, I know why he's using Tor. So how do you build one of these? The easy answer is that single hop proxy I was talking about before. So we've got these various Alices, and they each send all their traffic to the middle relay, and the relay goes out and gets it. So the first problem is, what if that big central point of failure fails? There are so many different ways that you can, maybe you can subpoena them, you can go look at the single cable that goes into their computer and comes out, and you can tap it. You can send a guy named Guido on an airplane to go gently ask them for all of their data. You can bribe the CEO, here's $50,000. Maybe they'll give up the data, they don't really care, it's not their data anyway. So that's one failure mode. A worse failure mode is, don't pay any attention to the relay itself, just look at all of these connections going into the relay, and the same connections going out. It's one cable that goes into the computer and another cable that comes out, and then just do the traffic analysis and start saying which of these flows coming in matches up to the which of these flows going out. And that math is surprisingly easy, and it's getting easier as the years go by. So we want something where there is no single cable, there's no relay, there's no central point that gets to learn which users are talking to which destination. So the idea there is to distribute the trust over multiple hops. So Alice is going to pick a path through several relays, and no single relay gets to learn which Alice is talking to which Bob. So if R1 is bad, if R1 is trying to figure out who's talking to who, he knows Alice is using Tor because he sees Alice talking, but he doesn't know what she's doing. He can't figure out what's going on the Bob end. And if R3 is bad, if he's trying to figure out who's talking to Bob, he knows somebody's talking to Bob, but he doesn't know who. And if R1 and R3 are collaborating, then we're screwed. So the security that Tor gives us, as the network gets larger and larger and we have a more diverse set of relays, then there are fewer and fewer attackers who are big enough, who are in the right place to be able to beat it. And then there's crypto, but I'm not going to talk about the crypto today. So that's our crash course on Tor. So far, so good. How many people here are Tor users? How many people here use Tor at least once a week? Perfect. Okay, so let's think a little bit more about this circumvention side, this censorship side. How do you build a tool that prevents people from blocking connections into Tor? One of the big challenges we had a few years ago was Tor provides good anonymity, but if governments can prevent people from reaching the Tor network, if they can block all these connections from Alice to the purple boxes, then it doesn't matter how good Tor is. If people can't reach the Tor network, then it's only for people in countries that are still willing to let people reach it. So let's think a little bit more about how to build one of these circumvention tools. The first thing to think about, there are two pieces to all of these proxying schemes. The first piece is what we call the relay component. How do you actually build your path? How do you get the encryption right? All that stuff I was talking about on the previous slides. And then the second piece is the discovery component. How do you learn what the relays are? How do you learn who you can connect to out there? And in the case of Tor, we have a really simple discovery component. There's a centralized directory. There are these 7 directory servers. I run one. The 2 people down there each run one. I think there's another person in here who runs one. So there are 7 people around the world that we all trust, and they never get into a single location at any given time. And as long as a majority of those 7 are good, are safe, are not lying to you, then they will produce a big list of all the relays, and it will be the right list. It'll be the same list that everybody else gets. So the way this works is all of these relays over here publish what's called a self-signed descriptor. They publish a little summary. Here's my IP address, exit policies, keys, stuff like that. And they send all of that to the 7 trusted directories, and then those authorities talk to each other and they produce a signed consensus saying, here are all the relays, their addresses, the timestamps you should expect to see from them, that sort of thing. And then multiply signed consensus gets cached on all the other relays and Alice fetches it. So it's a very simple discovery component. There's a directory, it lists all the relays, you get it, you're done. Now you know what the Tor network looks like. And that's great for most situations. It provides better anonymity properties than some other designs, but it's pretty straightforward to block. So how can attackers like the Chinese firewall block connections into the Tor network? So the first answer is there are those 7 authorities that I was talking about. And if you get their IP addresses, they're hard-coded in the Tor software, you block all 7, now nobody can bootstrap. The second approach is you pull down that list of 1,500 relays and you block all of them. China did that at the end of September. A third approach is you filter your traffic based on looking at the network fingerprint. You say, Tor is going to make a request. It's going to look like this on the wire. I can do TCP dump or something fancier and recognize that request, and then I'm going to hang up on that sort of thing. And an American company called SmartFilter and another American company called WebSense, back in 2007 or 2006 or something like that, they came up with a signature for how to recognize Tor traffic. And then they sold their software to Iran, UAE, Sudan, the list goes on and on. And that was how those countries were able to block connections to the Tor network. So that was back in 2007, and that's what got us all going here. We were thinking, I don't mind if Wikipedia, for example, wants to decide which Tor users are allowed to edit Wikipedia, but I do mind if countries are starting to say, you're not allowed to reach the Tor network, you're not allowed to have privacy, you're not allowed to decide for yourself what on the internet you're allowed to read. So that third approach was done for a little while in 2007, and then we fixed Tor so it was a lot harder to recognize the fingerprint. We made it look like SSL. And then there's the fourth approach. If you block torproject.org, then a lot of people who used to be using Tor now say, well, that was nice. Tor used to work, now it doesn't. And Tor still works. The network's still reachable, the software still works, but you can't get to the website, so you figure it's all shut down. So these are 4 different approaches that different countries have been using. So the approach that we've been, one of the approaches we've been using to solve this is what we call bridge relays. So we've got these purple relays over here. There's a big list of 1,500 of them. But we've got a few 100,000 users. We've got a whole lot of people over here. And what if we give them another button that says, I want to help censored users. I want to be a relay, not in the public list, not something that can easily be blocked, but I want to be a dark relay, a private relay, what we call a bridge relay. And the idea is you can bridge from somebody inside a country that can't reach Tor to the bridge to the Tor network. And that means that these bridges don't have to be exit relays. They don't have to deal with legal hassles from police and so on. They're just passing traffic from Tor to Tor. And they don't have to pass very much. If you've got 20,000, 50,000 bridges and 20,000 or 50,000 users, then 10 kilobytes, 20 kilobytes a second is a lot. So all of you who raised your hand earlier and said, yeah, I use Tor every week or so, you should turn yourself into a bridge. You should be one of these people who are available for the folks in China and Iran and other countries so that they can get through you to the rest of the Tor network. Okay, and one of the... Okay, so let's think a little bit more about what's actually happened over the past little while. Did I skip a slide? No, I didn't. Perfect. Okay. What's actually happened? Here is a graph of the number of people using Tor from Iran and from China in June. So right here is where the Iranian elections happened, and suddenly a whole lot of people in Iran were starting to say, I need to be able to reach external news sites in order to tell them what's going on in my country, and I need to reach Twitter, and I need to reach Facebook, because there's some sort of action or demonstration happening tonight. Where is it? Who is it? I need to learn these things. And it got to the point that there were 8,000 or 10,000 people a day using Tor, which is pretty cool. There were, I was talking to a the chief security officer of a Web 2.0 company in August or September, and they were tracking all of their users very well, and they wanted to know which users were coming from which IP addresses into their Iranian social networks. And so the challenge they had, their website got blocked inside Iran. I'm not going to specify which huge .com this is, but there are only a few big social networks out there. So their website got blocked from Iran, and they used to be thinking, man, I hate Tor. I can't track my users as well if they're coming over Tor, and my job is to turn users into money. And then suddenly in June, they were thinking, wow, Tor lets 10,000 people every day reach my website from Iran when they can't get there directly. I love Tor. Tor lets my users reach my website. So that's pretty cool. That's a pretty cool change. And they were actually seeing 10,000 people a day coming from Tor into their Iranian social network on that website. So I'm pretty sure that the numbers we have are actually less than what was actually going on. And for contrast, I've put China on the same graph, because during that whole thing in June, there were all these newspapers, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and so on, all writing about how critical it is for people in Iran to be able to reach the rest of the world. At the same time, we had way more people in China using Tor to be able to reach the rest of the world. So it's important to realize that it isn't just whatever country is in the headlines right now. It's a lot of other places all around the world that people forget about pretty easily. Right here, this was the Tiananmen Square anniversary, where there are a lot of people who were trying to figure out what that June 4th incident was. And over here was when China said, let's block Google Groups, Gmail, Google Search, Google Calendar, that sort of thing. So there were a lot of people who, when it was around here, were saying, I'm so glad my government censors the internet. I'm so glad they keep me safe. And then suddenly over here, they were saying, wait a minute, what the hell? They're censoring Google? That doesn't count as keeping me safe. That they're actually oppressing me. So that's certainly something that we can keep in mind for the rest of the talk, where there's really a fine line between keeping your citizens safe and happy and angering them about how you're censoring them. So what do we see in terms of bridge use in Iran during June? You'll notice that China here doesn't have that much of a jump, but people using bridges in Iran shot up a lot. So why do you need a bridge in this case? Because Iran didn't block Tor for any of June. Tor worked the whole time throughout June. Imagine if your government is really smart and they don't want to block Tor, they just want to be able to watch who's connecting to it. So they've got that list of 1,500 IP addresses, and they want to know who is connecting to those addresses. They've just bought their fancy new Nokia deep packet inspection boxes, so they're pretty good at watching their network at this point, and they want to know who's using it. I don't think this is actually the level of sophistication that the Iranian firewall was in June, but if you're really nervous and you want to be extra safe, then you could use a bridge so that your first connection connects to an address that they don't realize is Tor. So if you just look like an SSL connection and you're connecting to an IP address that's unaffiliated with Tor, then you'll be a lot safer. So one of the recommendations that we had for people while we were doing the whole June training recommendation thing was, if you want to be extra careful, if you're the person publishing to a blog, if you're the person running that Twitter account that everybody's listening to, maybe you should use a bridge in addition to using Tor, so it's a lot harder for people to recognize that you're actually connecting to the Tor network. So that was Iran in June. Now let's look a little bit at September. So the previous slides were the good news, and here's the not so good news. These are the number of people connecting to Jake's computer in September from China. And we've got 10,000 people a day or something for a little while, and then suddenly on September 25, it flatlines. And then there's a hiccup where they screw up their censorship, and then it flatlines again. So that sucks. That was the first time that anybody around the world had actually blocked the Tor network. And I did a talk here 3 or 4 years ago saying, it's easy to block the Tor network. Here's how you do it. It's kind of weird that nobody's done it so far. And part of the goal there is we're trying to lie a little bit lower than some of the other projects. We'll have a few more slides about that in a bit. So there are a lot of projects that show up to the New York Times and they say, we're going to conquer China. It's going to be great. And then the Chinese generals and the people in the political parties read that and they say, you have to solve this. But as long as Tor is mostly talking about civil liberties and let me tell you what's wrong with Germany and stuff like that, then we're in a little bit of a different situation than the people with the front page articles. So anyway, here's China. We lost most of our users that day, except here is the number of people using bridges from China during that same time. And a lot of that has to do with the social networks inside China. There were a lot of people on September 25 saying, hey, wait a minute, Tor doesn't work anymore. And then suddenly later on September 25, there were a lot of people telling their friends, okay, you're right, Tor doesn't work, you need a bridge. Let me teach you what a bridge is. Let me give you a few that I've got. Let me teach you how to learn some more. So we've got another graph later on that we made from showing that the number of people jumped up to, I don't know, 30,000, 40,000 people a day. And it's been pretty stable up there. So basically, all of our users switched on that day from, okay, they got censored if they're connecting directly to Tor, so now I'm going to switch to use a bridge. So in some sense, that's a sad story of China blocked the public Tor relays. But on the other hand, it's a success story because we had it wouldn't be that hard to do. Eventually, somebody will do it. So we'd already rolled out bridges. We'd already gotten a bunch of people running them. And it worked pretty well. Now there are lots of happy people in China using bridges. One of the other neat things, so the September 25 significance, on October 1, it was the 60th anniversary of some guy becoming in power in China. So they really wanted to shut down a lot of the different circumvention tools. And Tor was the only tool that worked throughout that week in China also. All the other tools got filtered, mostly by protocol, so they had to come up with a new protocol and push out a new version of their program and stuff like that. Okay, so how do you actually find a bridge? There are a couple of different ways that we've automated, and then there are some ways that we didn't automate, because if you automate them, then they're easier to break. So the first one is you go to https://bridges.torproject.org, and it looks at what IP address you're coming from, and it counts Tor separately. And then it gives you a few bridge answers. And if you come from the same address again, it gives you the same answers again. And that means that if you want to learn all the different bridges that are available through that approach, then you have to come from a lot of different places on the internet. And we didn't have a good sense of how hard that would be for people to do. Turns out that on September 25, China did that. They learned all the bridges that were available through this first approach. So if you were using a bridge that you learned that way, it didn't work. You had to find another bridge some other way. The second approach is you get a Gmail account and you email us at bridges@torproject.org, and then we answer you with a few bridges. And if you want to learn lots of bridges, you need to make lots of Gmail accounts, and we leave it up to Google to decide how hard it is to make lots of Gmail accounts. So rather than learning how to make CAPTCHAs and having to get into that whole field, we leverage the fact that Google's already doing that, and they make it hard for you to learn lots of bridges. And China didn't break this one. So there are a few hundred bridges or something like that available through that approach right now. And then on that day, we were thinking, oh crap, one of our two designs just got broken. What are we going to do next? We had some bridges in reserve that we hadn't given out in any way. And at that point, I found a friend of mine in Shanghai and said, here are 40 bridges. Do something good with them. And he set up a password-protected Twitter account and signed up his 1,200 closest friends. And he's well-connected. He's got lots of friends. And apparently he chose his 1,200 people very well because he was Twittering a few bridge addresses every day, and those all worked great. So that's another example of the social network approach. And we certainly need to think more about what other strategies we should be using down the road. And we'll talk about that more in a bit also. Okay, so one of the other things to keep in mind here, we need some way to aggregate where the bridges are in order to give them out. So just as I was talking before about the central Tor directory authorities, we also have bridge authorities. So when you run a bridge, your bridge automatically uploads its server descriptor, its summary, address, keys, stuff like that, to the bridge authority, and then the bridge authority is able to keep track of it and give it out and so on. And one of the really neat things about the bridge authority And we haven't taken advantage of this as much as we should. Hopefully we'll be rolling it out in the next year or so. The idea is, when you're running a bridge relay, it's just like a normal Tor relay. It's got an IP address, but it also has an identity key. So the goal is, if we tell the users, here's its current IP address, and here's its identity key, and the bridge is on a dynamic IP address or something like that, so it changes its IP address every so often, as long as the user knows the identity key, and they've got some way to reach the bridge authority, for example, they have a bridge that still works, then they can connect through Tor to the bridge authority and say, I know the identity key, can you tell me where he is now? So that would mean that once you've got five or six bridges, as long as they don't all disappear at once, then you can use the ones that are still working to be able to follow the other ones. And this is all software, it all happens in the background. So one of the neat things here, the goal for this whole circumvention thing, the original problem was, how do you publish 1,500 IP addresses to the whole world and keep them out of the hands of the Chinese government, which is an impossible problem, to how do you take these 10,000 or 20,000 or 30,000 bridge addresses and give them out one at a time to the good guys without letting the bad guys learn all of them? And that's hopefully an arms race that we can handle better. The big problem with that arms race right now is we have 400 bridges, not 10,000 or 20,000. So all of those people who are running Tor clients right now, they should become bridges. We don't need very much bandwidth. You're not going to end up blacklisted by anybody because nobody even knows that you're running the bridge. So that's a really important thing that you guys can help us do over the next while. There are a lot of people in Iran and China and other places who would really like to be able to reach the Tor network, and there's certainly an arms race going on right now between China and other places trying to hunt down the bridges we've got and the people who are trying to use them trying to learn about new ones. Okay, so what else have we been working on? That's mostly how do you change the discovery problem so that there's a way for them to find an IP address that they can connect to? At the same time, you also have to think about the network fingerprint side of things. Originally, we did plain text HTTP for our directory fetches, and that's how SmartFilter and WebSense and so on were able to block it. They could actually, we did an HTTP request for /tor/something, and easy to block, easy to find. So we fixed that. Now we look pretty much like Firefox talking to Apache over SSL. And one of the really neat things there, Iran kicked out SmartFilter earlier this year. They said, we don't need those Western pigs running our network. We can run our network just fine. And that meant that the old version of Tor started working again because they weren't filtering based on the old fingerprint. And one of the really neat things is about half of the people in Iran in June were using the old version of Tor from 2007. So these are people who years ago installed Tor and said, oh, that's kind of neat. And then they forgot about it. And then suddenly their neighbor said, you can get to Twitter and Facebook if you have Tor installed. And they said, oh, I already have Tor installed. I'll try it. So the fact that Iran decided to grow its own homebrew censoring system meant that the version of Tor that these people had from years ago started working again. That's kind of a neat feature. One of the other weird things at that point, Iran was an unusual combination in June because they were really bad at understanding the internet. They were really incompetent at filtering the internet at the beginning of June, but they were really, really good at physically tracking people down and arresting them and finding them and so on. So it was a weird sort of imbalance where the internet worked great if you knew how to use it, and real world was really hard to keep safe. And there are still people coming through the Iranian firewall using newfangled protocols. I'm not going to specify what comes after IPv4 so that people will block it. But if you use some other protocols, then they don't censor things very well. Okay, so let's think a little bit more about what sort of things we're up against. What is the attacker trying to do here? So there are two big things that they're trying to do. They're trying to block certain types of information, stuff that's embarrassing, rights violations, corruption, that sort of thing, and stuff that's opposing, opposition movements. So if people are actually trying to, let's meet at this street corner and have a protest, those are the sorts of things they're trying to block. And they don't have to block everything. They don't have to shut down all the websites. They don't have to shut down all the circumvention tools. All they have to do is give people the impression that they're still in control. So they really just have to shut down the tools that are really effective. If millions of people are using it, they've got to do something about it. And the ones that are really visible, really loud. So if there's a New York Times article every day on how this particular tool is bringing freedom to Iran, then they have to do something about that. So part of our challenge was, how do we find the right balance where we stay completely out of the Western press, but through word of mouth and other approaches, we tell everybody in these countries who needs to know about Tor how a bridge works, how you get one, things like that. Another thing to keep in mind, they're not going to go after people who passively read information. I keep talking to security experts who say, well, all China needs to do is find 20 Tor users in China, kill them publicly, and then nobody's going to use Tor again. And I was at a conference with a bunch of Chinese people, and I told them this story, and they all laughed. They're like, China's not going to kill 20 Tor users. Come on. They're ordinary citizens. They can't do that. They can't afford to do that. So part of the thing to keep in mind here from talking to people on the ground in these places, if you read the Wikipedia article on freedom in China, they're not going to do anything. They don't care. If you wrote the Wikipedia article on freedom in China, then they really do care. So there are a small number of really important publishers out there that need to keep really safe. And there are a whole lot of other people who they need their circumvention. They need to get around the firewall, but they're not going to get rounded up and killed just for reading the wrong article. And one of the neat things about Tor is, if you're watching somebody using Tor, if you know they're a Tor user, it's not clear which class this person's in. If there are 50,000 people in China, and 8 of them are writing on their blogs, and 49,900 some are reading blogs, then there's a lot of cover for people to blend in with. And then another thing to keep in mind, which is another variation on that, a lot of countries have various incentives not to block the whole thing. When I started on this, I was thinking, okay, so if I make China turn off the internet, did I win or did I lose? And at this point, it doesn't matter, because China's not going to turn off the internet. They can't afford to. But a lot of places don't mind collateral damage for a while. I think India a couple of years ago had an interesting story where somebody in Pakistan published something on a blog, something religious, and India said, there's going to be a war if our citizens read that, so you should censor that website. So they went to the top ISPs in India and said, can you please censor these 3 websites? So they did. And it turned out to be a website that nobody there had heard of called, I think it was Blogspot. And so India censored Blogspot for 3 days. And that made a lot of people in India really angry because they said, well, wait a minute, I thought I lived in a democracy and they're censoring 50,000 blogs. What's going on here? One of the other interesting pieces from that, pretty much exactly the same story happened 6 or 7 years ago in Thailand. Thailand was one of the first countries that blocked torproject.org, that blocked people reaching our domain. And I kept hearing from people in Thailand, I live in a democracy. They're blocking the web. I'm going to sue. They can't do this. And then a few years later, the tanks roll, and it turns out they don't quite live in a democracy. So part of the challenge of working on Tor, part of the feature of working on Tor, is we hear before these things happen from people in alleged democracies who are suddenly being censored in different ways. Okay, so what sort of attacks do we have in mind here? How do people actually censor their networks? The first ones are pretty much universal, blocked by IP address or port at the firewall. Another one is you intercept DNS requests and you try to, if somebody's asking for WikiLeaks.com, then you send them to a local page saying, this is content you should not be looking at as a good citizen. If you're lucky, you get that sort of page in Saudi Arabia or something like that. In China, they just send you to a blank page or you get a did not resolve or something like that. China has another trick where they look inside the TCP packets for certain keywords that they don't want you to say, like Falun, for example. If you're talking about certain religions, then they will send reset packets in both directions. Iran has bought all this newfangled hardware from American and European corporations, so they're doing deep packet inspection to identify SSL, even if you do it on something other than port 443. Russia has its own tricks. They don't actually filter the internet, at least not very much. Instead, they just pollute the blogosphere. So there are a lot of people in Russia who try to organize something or they want to tell people what's going on in their country. And then there are 50 other people paid by the Russian government to go make other blogs saying, oh, that's not true. It's actually like this. So if you're trying to read the internet from Russia, you can read everything, but you've got no idea who's who and what they're saying and so on. China has their own version of this called the 50 cent party, where they're paid 50.5 Chinese currency units for every post that they make, talking about how great China is and how these people aren't really that unhappy with their country. And come on, it's all going fine. And I just bought my third television. So why are you people so upset? So part of the challenge here is that there are so many different ways to filter the internet, to block things. And different countries are starting with different tricks. I was talking to a fellow from China recently, and China now uses all of these. They're buying their own DPI boxes, and they've got the 50 cent party, and so on. So a lot of these tricks are spreading from one place to another. So what else are we up against? Long ago, 2 or 3 years ago, pretty much all of these firewalls were stateless. In SmartFilter's case, they look at what website you're going to, what URL, and they decide right then, can you get there or not? In the case of the Chinese firewall, they look at each packet as it goes by. And if that packet convinces them that you should stop talking, then they kill your connection. But they don't remember things. They don't build a profile and start doing statistics or glue the packets back together like firewalls have to do. They were stateless. These days, everybody's buying fancier hardware. And so the challenge is getting a lot more on the DPI level. So we need to, there's still differences between some countries and the other countries. For example, in Iran, sometimes they turn off the internet, but sometimes they leave it on. They have a little knob, basically, and when they get anxious or some political thing's going to happen, they turn the knob and the internet goes away. And they've been working on getting a better knob lately, so they can turn the SSL knob without turning the whole internet knob. And that means that you can still browse the web, but you can't use SSL, so they get to watch everything you're doing. So China can't afford to do that. They can't turn their internet off. There are too many people in China who are using it for too many different things. And they also can't afford to turn SSL off. There's a lot of industry, economics, business that's using encryption and wanting to be safe on the net. So China walks a lot finer of a line than we realize, where they can't make too many people angry. Right now, the reason why these people are in charge is because most of the people in their country are saying, oh, it's not that bad. And if they do too much, then too many people are going to get upset. And contrast this with Burma, where step one of the coup is turn off that internet thing because I don't like it. And it's pretty much still off at this point. So there's a spectrum of different approaches that countries are able to take in terms of how much they can turn things off. And Iran is a weird situation. It's in the middle where the government thinks that it can turn the internet off, and it's got the technical capability to. But there are a lot of really angry people in Iran when that happens. And every time they do it, there are a lot more really angry people in Iran. So it's only a matter of time until something happens there. One of the other key points, a lot of these filtering techniques, it's not like China is inventing new things and then going to talk to the people in Iran or Burma or whatever. Cisco is inventing new things. And then China pays Cisco to invent a new product. And then once China has invested and Cisco has built the product, then Cisco goes to Iran and says, we've got this fantastic product. Would you like to buy it? And it's not just Cisco. It's Fortinet and whatever secure computing is doing next. And the list goes on and on of American and Western corporations that are building the technology to censor people around the world. That sucks. So one of the questions, one of the things we need to brainstorm is most of these companies are selling these products to other Western corporations to prevent their employees from watching happytreefriends.com or whatever during their lunch hour. They don't make that much money from Iran. How do we make it so that the products that they're selling make most of their customers happy, and then they're done? Right now, the problem is it's exactly the same product that Boeing wants to oppress its employees as Iran wants to oppress its citizens. How do we make it so that Boeing ends up happy and Iran doesn't get the products they want? I don't know the answer to that. And with that, I'm going to skip to a 5-minute discussion from Jake of what he's been up to lately, and then we'll go back to some other things. Is my goon here with a microphone? Perfect. Does it work?
Yeah, hi. I'm Jake, and I work on the Tor project. I just came back from a month traveling in the Middle East, where I was in Lebanon, Qatar, Egypt, and Jordan. And it was a really interesting experience, and I think that probably the most interesting thing is that I realized what the future of the West looks like by going to the Middle East. You can laugh at this, but it's actually quite scary. Someone wrote me an email, I think you're in the audience probably, but I don't know what you look like, that basically said that there is a country in the Middle East soon that will be recording all of the YouTube videos that this country basically will request. So every user in the country that watches YouTube, the full TCP connection will be logged and sent to the state for review. And they have mandatory data retention in this country, so that means that forever, every YouTube video you ever watch will be tied to your permanent record, right? And it's built, I think, a product built here in Germany, by the way. So a little national pride is in order for that. So this is very scary, but I mean, it's Nokia that is doing this, it's Cisco that's doing this, it's Alcatel that's doing this. It's not just unique to Germany. But you see, in places like Egypt, I met some relay operators. There's someone that runs a Tor relay there. And what he faces is that they have mandatory data retention there as well. So he is potentially risking his life by running a Tor relay, I think. We need more people in the West who have great freedom and that have essentially a great amount of resource available to them. So like if you have an internet connection and it's not running a Tor server, you can really make a difference directly. Because some of these people, they are risking their life to be a part of this because they believe it. And they're in the extreme minority in the place in which they are. Without mutual aid between people in different countries, we really don't have much of a chance to be able to resist the data retention, the filtering, and the policing that comes later. Because ultimately what we have is a situation where the trail of data that we leave behind tells a story that is not necessarily true. And that's the really scary thing. If you visit a YouTube video because your friend sends you a link, like a mini URL link, and it's like a political video and you had no idea, and you get that sent a couple of times from different places, it makes you look perhaps more political than you actually are. And when they go to round people up, which they do in places like Iran right now, then you're fucked. And it's not funny. It's terrifying. And there are people that are being put in jail for 60 years in Iran for some of their online activities, right? So it's not a theoretical thing. It's a very practical thing. And if you do not fall directly in line with some of the state belief systems in some places, it's the end for you. And so it's very important that we organize in order to change this. And one of the things that we need to do, we need to infiltrate the companies that build these systems. I just killed my career in computer security, and I'm okay with that. But what we need is if every person in this room goes and gets a job at Alcatel, at Cisco, if they go and get jobs at these filtering companies, if they go and work in the countries where this is happening and they find out how it's being installed, where it is being installed, we know what to sabotage, what to leak, and we know how to get around it, how to circumvent it, and how to beat it. Because ultimately, at the end of the day, Tor is a stopgap. Because the social measures that these firewalls create are hugely successful. But if we can resist them on a social level as well as a technical level, then we can win. And unfortunately, it is, I believe, an arms race where we are quickly losing everywhere, with data retention especially. So I hope that all of you will go and do something, at least running a Tor server, but hopefully infiltrating a large company and changing the world.
And you don't actually have to go get a job at these places. You might know somebody who works there. You might happen to run across a strategic document from one of them while you're surfing the web. There are a lot of organizations out there like WikiLeaks who would be happy to help coordinate with you. So if you happen to find these documents somewhere, I would really love to know what the strategic plan is for various companies out there. Are they actually saying, how do we build a product that Iran will buy? Or are they saying, how do we build a product that Boeing will buy, and then let's make a buck off of Iran while we're doing it? What's their plan? What are they up to?
The latter, not the former. As somebody who started the WSA product in
Ironport, which is now So if it's the latter, as this woman says, then maybe we can put a divide in there. Maybe we can put a wedge in there so that they make their money off of Boeing and there's no money left to be made off of Iran. Certainly, it's not just a technical problem. It's a social problem. It's a political problem. There are governments out there wondering right now, how do we penalize companies that are killing people in other countries? So the question is there cryptography in these products? If yes, then it's illegal. Illegal to sell to Iran doesn't matter. Like the president of Secure Computing said, oh, we don't sell to Iran. We don't do any of that. And there's a picture of him shaking hands with the head firewall guy in Iran. So, but that's a separate discussion for a separate time. Okay, so what else are we up against? We'll go through a couple of other topics to think about and then break in a little bit. So another thing to keep in mind, there are a lot of countries and companies out there. You've all heard of the Yahoo thing before, yahoo.cn. There was a fellow in China who was using Yahoo email server, and then China went to Yahoo and said, who is this guy? We want to know because he's our citizen, and we want to make him a better citizen. And Yahoo said, why, certainly, you are a country, and we follow the laws of every country. Here is your citizen. That sucks. So the answer that a lot of companies are having right now is, okay, we're not going to put our data centers in China. We'll put them nearby and then no problem. That works great while China is the only bad country in the world. But China is not the only bad country in the world. So how, do we just keep on moving everything into Iceland? I'd like a better answer than that.
It just got better. Now there's Iceland.
Just got better. Now there's Iceland. Another fun thing to keep in mind, blocking goes both ways. So if China black holes your IP address because you're running a Tor relay, you can't surf Baidu, the Chinese search engine. So if they black hole a Tor relay that's an exit relay, then somebody who wants to reach a Chinese blog through Tor can't get there because it's blocked in both directions. So they're preventing people from reaching that IP address, and that means you can't reach the Chinese blog from Tor either, which is something that I had no idea that was going to happen before I started realizing that, wait a minute, once they've blocked the public addresses, then blocking goes in both directions. The other neat part of that is if you run your Tor relay on a dynamic IP address, then slowly all of your neighbors can't reach China, which, not sure if that was intentional or unintentional or what, but China's eventually going to cut itself off from the rest of the internet if this is really their strategy. Another thing to keep in mind, Tor is only a piece of the puzzle. There are a lot of other pieces that we need to solve if we're going to get this stuff right. One of them, I have to assume that your local computing setup is pretty safe. You don't have spyware installed. You're not in an internet cafe in Beijing where they've got a video camera pointing at you and your screen, stuff like that. Another piece of that, there's a lot more than just Tor that people need to learn how to use correctly. I was just talking to a blogger from Vietnam a month or so ago, and he was saying, yeah, I use Yahoo because everybody uses Yahoo. And last week, all of our passwords got changed. What happened? So how do we teach these people about SSL and how to be safe and all the other programs and tools that they need to use well? Another example of that, in June, when Jake and I and other people were trying to teach people in Iran how to do things safely, they're like, oh, I have a plain text proxy. It's great. I'm just using it. And we're like, it's a plain text proxy. Anybody who looks at any of your traffic knows every destination. They know your Twitter account. They know your password. They know everything. But they were happy using their plain text proxy. So many of them have learned over the past month or something like that. But it's still a challenge there in terms of educating people about general safety. Another question, do you really have the right version of Tor? So if you're in the US or Europe, you know what GPG signatures are. On my business card is my PGP key that signs the Tor source code. You can make sure you've got the right Tor. But what if you're in Burma? I meet very few people from Burma. How do they know they've got the right Tor? There was another horrible example a little while ago of people using Skype in China, where Skype partnered with a company called Tom to produce Tom Skype. And as part of the partnering, as part of the translation part, they made it Chinese version, which had a backdoor in it, which if you ever said any wrong keywords, then they wrote down everything you said and sent it to a central location. So one of my fears eventually is the bad guys are going to start sending out versions of Tor that I didn't write. And the worst case scenario is I get a lot of mail from people in China saying, hey, Roger, torproject.org works again. I can reach it. Now I'm using Tor. And what they've actually done is they mirrored the website. They do a DNS redirect. So when you come from inside China, you get this other website that looks totally like the Tor website, except you're running Tom Tor. So how can we solve that? We've got an email autoresponder now where you mail gettor@torproject.org from your Gmail account, and we send you Tor. That's pretty good. In Iran, they don't use the internet much because people keep turning the knob down. So they're passing things around by USB key or something like that, and hopefully you get it from a friend who has the right version. Okay, so a couple other things to think about. In September, when they blocked all the public relays, we had a couple of choices to make. And we went to our friends in China who are expert about these things, and we got two different answers. The first answer was, hit them in the nose, show that you're for real. Put out a new version of Tor right now that isn't blocked, and show all the people in China that you're not going to take this, that you can go head on head with the Chinese government and keep going. And the other version, the other advice we got was, let it pass. It's just China. Bridges still work. Don't fight them. The more you fight them, the more they're going to fight you. And we decided the second approach seemed like a much better strategy, where Tor is useful in a lot of different places. It still works in China. It still works in Iran if you've got a bridge. And the goal is not to make a piece of software that works out of the box no matter what, even if you don't know anybody. The goal is to make a piece of software that once you've got a bridge, then you're in business. And we're changing the idea. A lot of people in China, a lot of bloggers, are currently thinking, my program doesn't work, I need to get a new version of the program. And the new idea is, your program's going to work the whole time, you need to get a new bridge. So hopefully that teaches them a little bit more about how you could build these things. Okay, so I'm running a little bit low on time. I'll skip a few things. Another thing to think about. I think it was February, there was a fellow named Hal Roberts from the Harvard Berkman Center who he was looking through the frequently asked questions list of some of the other circumvention tools out there, the more proprietary ones that don't tell you how they work. And one of the questions he found was, do you sell user data? And the answer was, yes, and the more you pay us, the more precise the data is. And a lot of people freaked out at that because they're thinking, I'm using this tool and obviously the tool is keeping me safe. Whereas the people operating the tool are thinking, there are users, we let them reach websites, of course we sell their data. How else are we going to stay in business? So a lesson there is a lot of these tools see circumvention and privacy as totally separate things. And our lesson from that is they have to be the same thing. If there is a database out there of every YouTube video you've watched from a certain country, if it's the government keeping it, that's bad. If it's the censorship tool, the anti-censorship tool keeping it, that's also bad. So the goal of Tor is to not have any of these bottlenecks. A couple other things to think about. Australia. There are a lot of people all around the world, there are a lot of countries all around the world that are thinking, wouldn't it be great if we censor our internet too? And this is bad for a couple of different reasons. One of the big reasons is, every time a country like Denmark or Germany or Australia or whatever tries to build a list of all the bad websites in the world, they get it wrong. They put too many things on it. They do it in secret. They never have any transparency or anything like that in terms of what actually goes on the list. So they end up censoring Republican websites or stuff like that. That's the first problem. The second problem is, when governments go to China and they say, stop being a bad country, you're censoring your internet, only bad countries censor their internet, China has a great answer right now. China's answer is, what? Denmark censors their internet. Australia censors their internet. England censors their internet. Canada censors their internet. New Zealand's working on censoring their internet. Stop picking on me. Everybody does it. We're just being safe on the internet. So since other countries that are allegedly free are thinking about censoring their internet, that gives a free pass to places like China and Iran to do it also. That sucks. We need to start working on fixing things around here, or we're not going to have any chance of fixing things elsewhere. And I think I'm going to skip to pretty much the end. One of the other things we've been working on is how do we do advocacy and education. I just moved quite close to Washington, D.C. There are an unending stream of people making critical policy decisions in Washington, D.C., and they don't understand technology at all. So one of my side hobbies is to go down to D.C. and teach as many senator aides and policy people as possible about what this internet thing is and why privacy matters and who uses Tor and why. And you guys need to do that to all of your policymakers and political people and legal people and so on, wherever you live. I went to Stuttgart to talk to a bunch of detectives a few years ago here in Germany, and hopefully I'm going to talk to some more police in Berlin this summer. If you know any police who would like to learn more about Tor and they speak English, please introduce them to me, because I would love to teach them what Tor is and why it's useful at this point. And then a last point, technical solutions are not going to solve the whole problem. There are a lot of people right now in China and Iran and Denmark and Germany and England and so on who are saying, oh, come on, it's not so bad. I'm glad my government's keeping me safe. So we need to fix the social side of things. But there are also good technical reasons. There are a lot of people out there who need to post on their blog. They need to tweet what's going on. They need to reach WikiLeaks. And we're building a tool for those people, and hopefully the rest of the world will get to use it too. You should run a bridge. I know I've said that, but I'll say it again. You should run a bridge. Thank you. We may have time for a question or two. Are we out? Or
unfortunately, due to time limits, maybe one quick question, maybe?
And then I will be around for the rest of the day and the Congress. I'm easy to spot.
No.
There's a question down there.
Just one remark. Thanks for highlighting the companies. We highlighted them in one of the German Big Brother Awards this year, and I have to get the English version of that speech online. More about running bridges. Does it make sense to do that if you're just running it for a browser behind a NAT device for a small amount of time, like one surf session? Does that help?
So the question is, does it help to run a bridge even if you're not going to be connected for very long or something like that? The answer is yes. The more bridges we have, the more use we can make of them. We're still working on coming up with ways to make better use of a bridge that's only around for a little while. And the other version of that question is, if you are not reachable from the internet, is it still useful? And the answer to that currently is no, alas. So if you can port forward or something like that, then you should run a bridge. And if you can't port forward, then come talk to us and remind us that you would like to be useful, but you can't yet. And with that, I'm going to be outside answering more questions. Thank you.